Hello, everyone. I'm John Miklos, editor-in-chief and publisher of SOCCentral.com, and I'll be the moderator of today's session presented to you by Open Systems Media on power-aware design of complex SOCs. You're going to hear from two presenters today, Steve Carlson from Cadence Design Systems and Steve Hamilton from Sonix, Inc. The presentations today were about 50 minutes, and you'll have about 10 minutes for questions and answers after the presentation. But before we begin, there's a couple of buttons I'd like to point out to you on your audience console to make this presentation a bit easier to follow and use. First of all, you'll see an enlarge slides button on your console. Use this button if you'd like to enlarge the slides at any time to fill the entire screen. To the right of this button, you'll see a download slides button. If you'd like to print copies of the slides, you can download them and then have a hard copy to follow along with the presenters. The button labeled forward to a friend, you can use if you'd like to send an email to someone that they can include, which includes a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend while the presentation's in progress. To the left of these, you'll see a window that lets you answer questions in real time. You can submit a question at any time during the presentation, and we'll do our best to get to them during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question about the operation of the eCast itself at any time, please enter it and submit it, and one of our technicians will respond to you during the eCast. Because we have limited time, we might not get to all of your questions today, even though you may be very eager to have them answered. There's simply not enough time to get to all the questions that we might get on a very hot topic as power-aware design. If we haven't answered your questions, however, someone will get back to you after the eCast with more information, or you can contact either Cadence or Sonix directly. During the presentations, you'll also have an opportunity to participate in a couple of quick polls, and a closing survey will also pop up on your screen after the Q&A. Please take a minute or so to fill out the survey before leaving the eCast. Last point, this eCast will be posted online within 24 hours, and an audio podcast will also be available. But more details about this at the end of the presentation. Our first presenter today is Steve Carlson from Cadence Design Systems. Steve is the Vice President of Marketing at Cadence Design and responsible for mixed signal and low power solutions. Steve joined Cadence in April 2003 via the Get the Chip acquisition, where he was the VP of marketing. Prior to Get the Chip, Steve was the CEO of Tara Systems, a hardware acceleration company. Steve has also held various management positions at Escalade, LSI Logic, United Technologies, and Synopsys. At Synopsys, Steve was part of the original design compiler technical team responsible for timing analysis and optimization. Steve was the author of the industry's first book on high-level design titled Introduction to HDL-Based Design Using VHDL. Steve has a BSEE and a BSCS and an MSEE, all from the University of Colorado. Steve, you now have the floor, and can you start at any time?
Okay, thanks a lot, John. So this morning I'd like to give a brief introduction to low power design from a Cadence perspective, but starting from a little bit higher level, and then we'll dive into some of the detail and following. The following presentation from Sonix is going to get you to an even greater degree of depth. When we think about low power design, it's something that's been done since the beginning of semiconductor design, really. And more recently, I think people have the connotation of portable devices such as cell phones and MP3 players and the like, or laptops, and that's of course true because battery life is such a key consideration, and power consumption in ICs is a major contributor to battery life or the consumption of energy. But over the past 3 or so years, there's been a lot more design activity pretty much across the spectrum of electronics design related to energy efficiency. Some of that's been spurred by government programs mandating more green approaches to the consumption of power, and sometimes just as part of the value proposition relating to cost of ownership of a data center, for instance, or for devices like that are plugged in, like printers, maybe just the cost of the bill of materials, being able to eliminate a heat sink, for instance, on key processing ICs. We also see some very active optimization opportunities in looking at true system levels and things like building operations optimization. And these are things that, as we look to future opportunities, are quite interesting in terms of contributing to a more energy efficient world. When we look down into IC design, we really look at power as not a singular concern, but it's part of an overall optimization of both process and design. There are sets of features that need to be created within a given schedule, and there's also cost and performance metrics that go along with the power. And you can't consider power by itself without the consideration of these other aspects of design. And that really calls for a global approach to the optimization, or what we call multi-objective optimization. And we do this throughout the Cadence design flow, being power aware rather than in all of the tools across the from conceptualization through the final sign-off, and rather than treating it as a sequential approach to power by itself and then trying to reconverge into a timing closure flow, for instance. The other consideration that needs to be taken is that power is not just a digital concern. A lot of the knowledge and industry activity has surrounded the digital implementation. But if we look at modern SoCs, there's a lot of analog signal content today. And we also push out into the package and look for opportunities for energy efficiency using techniques like die stacking, where we can reduce the driver strength on the individual dies as well as reduce the interconnect length that has a direct proportion to the energy consumption. And you see this becoming popular in processor systems, but it's going to also be taking off in mixed signal context as well, where you see system in package as well as the through silicon via the TSV kinds of techniques being applied. As we look at the design flow from specification and architecture design into power, defining the power architecture, and then into the normal RTL to GDS flow, one of the key considerations, as I mentioned before, is that power must be an integral part of the design process. It can't be a side excursion. To make this successful, you need to have the predictability throughout the process and then the feedback to ensure that there isn't any divergence. So this idea of being able to get into this V of continuous convergence is very critical to success in low-power design, and using techniques that look ahead in the design process to improve the predictability is a necessary complement to the low-power design technique implementation itself. The Cadence strategy is built on three fundamental pieces: the products themselves, the software products that you're all familiar with, complementary service offerings that fill in the gaps that may exist in terms of the end customer's design knowledge or capabilities, so they may have gaps in staffing, particularly more recently, as well as the underlying ecosystem that drives from a process and foundry perspective, but also the various elements of IP and third-party services as well. If you look at the tableau of the product offerings, you can see that we've colored green there quite a bit of our entire product portfolio, denoting that power is integrated into the design flow pretty much pervasively at this point. A little more detail on that, if we categorize the technologies, the design technologies that we have into design, verification, and predictability, you'll see that there is a full expanse in the design capability, starting from chip planning, that's early design planning, as well as high-level synthesis and algorithmic design, and then into the digital implementation and package design as well. In the verification, we have a closed-loop, power-aware verification flow that starts at the system level and goes all the way through sign-off and the emulation technologies as well. And this turns out to be one of the key risk factors that customers look at in adopting advanced low-power design techniques, is What will it mean from a functional perspective, and how do I mitigate the risk of improper operation? And this can be done using this idea of a closed-loop verification flow that ensures the functional behavior with respect to the power functions of the design are correct and they interact correctly with the normal function as well. And that can be verified throughout the implementation flow to sign off. And finally, the power predictability helps provide technologies and links into the other two activities of verification and design such that you can improve the power strategy for your chip and continue to monitor its effectiveness as you get all the way through the sign-off process. If we look again at a more abstract view of what happens through the design process from chip planning all the way to sign-off, you see that the ideal curves we're looking at have to do with a continuous process towards convergence of the design criteria on the one hand, and then the normalized predictability of the power on the other hand. If we look at the solutions provided by other vendors, you'll see that we get less than an ideal progression towards a final power-closed design. It has to do with a number of factors that cause those oscillations in design. Starting at the leftmost, having no visibility into the system design in RTL is a gap that we see in a lot of design flows. You see oscillation because the RTL, the initial functional description, has not been in any way optimized for power or maybe for a previous generation of process technology. There's difficulty integrating IP, and also the impact of mixed signal design can have a pretty big impact on what the overall power profile to the chip looks like. The different test cases or switching activity profiles that might be applied have a very dramatic effect on the dynamic power consumption in particular. You can have poor correlation between the power engines if you're using tools from different parts of the system. Often use different sorts of assumption for activity propagation, for instance. As you get towards silicon realization and you start to intercept with the software part of the overall program, you can see that a lot of variability again can happen with regards to the actual overarching function of the system as well, and that relates back to the switching activity prediction. And then failure to consider what's going to happen as a result of the packaging decisions that are made at the devices as well as the multi-device level can cause a lot of variability. What that means, all of those words mean that you might have to do some iteration, and we see this very often as a result of power. And I think everyone's familiar with iteration resulting from failure in the timing closure process. We see a lot more projects that are being delayed because of power closure and the surprises that you see. It's become a primary design criteria, and it's causing schedule slips. No longer are people saying, well, I'll worry about power on the next rev of the design. The Cadence solution we have depicted here, it's not perfect, but we've done a lot of investment to ensure that you get a much more uniform process towards closure. It starts from the chip planning process, and we have a tool we call Insight that lets you create a early view of the chip and overlay a power strategy on top of that with multiple operating modes, and you can add as much detail as you like, whether or not using power gating, et cetera, and look at the impact on the power dissipation along with the functional content and the performance aspects of the chip. So you can start to make trade-offs very early in the planning process before you start design. In the early power design process, we can start to create more power-optimized RTL by taking advantage of the system level or behavioral synthesis technologies we have in our C-to-silicon technology. This enables you to explore different architectural alternatives in trading off performance and through throughput for power dissipation. The next level of design is eliminating the continual power surprises and being able to go through a successive refinement process using the power prediction and exploration capabilities embodied in the RTL compiler product, as well as leveraging the capability to integrate in IP using a very flexible methodology that supports both top-down and bottom-up IP integration that includes their own power strategies underneath each IP component. As we move further into the design flow, we can prevent iterations by ensuring that we have a coherent and consistent power strategy that overlays on the normal functional operation. And we use our simulation technologies in Incisive as well as in the emulation products to ensure functional correctness in the presence of the power strategy of the design, as well as using conformal low power to ensure the fidelity of the design and its power strategy throughout the implementation process. The correlation that you see through the emulation technologies is quite important as well. This enables us to connect into that software development process that I talk about as well. You can run millions and millions of cycles on in emulation. It lets you look at the effects of different embedded software strategies, more parallel versus serial execution on the SoC, for instance, to dampen the peak power would be one of the applications that we see, or looking at various different strategies for system power down and standby modes that are controlled by the software components of the system. There's also a dynamic power analysis capability in the emulation technology that runs concurrently with the functional operation, and this enables you to identify those peak power and debug exactly where it is on the SoC in order to figure out where you need to focus your energies, be they from a functional or from a physical implementation process. The power aware prototyping capability extends into the physical implementation process as we start looking at the grid power grid design and the delivery of the power shutoff capability are key components to the closure process. You're starting to get down into single-digit kinds of optimizations that where you can improve the power dissipation. There's still more that can be ground out of the design, but if you don't pay attention, you can start to have double-digit losses if you're not power aware throughout the implementation and final sign-off flows. So when we look at overall the investment that we've made over the past 5 years in the power closure design process here, we give ourselves pretty high marks compared to competitors, where we've looked at the process from a completely holistic standpoint, from top to bottom, from chip planning to final sign-off, and really don't have much competition when you look at the entirety of the process and ensuring that there aren't any surprises along the way. So that's just a brief overview that I brought today. I have been working on this for about 5 years now, and there's a lot more technical depth behind what I showed you, and I'd certainly welcome the opportunity to engage with you in this forum, or if you'd like to follow up individually, please contact me. And John, with that, I'd like to turn it back over to you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Steve. That was a nice presentation. Our next presenter is Steve Hamilton from Sonix. Steve is senior architect with Sonix and has more than 30 years' experience in the computer and semiconductor industries. His background includes chip development of both ASIC and custom ICs, including analog design, but more significantly, or also significant, CAD software development expertise spanning logic simulation, place and route tools, and silicon compilation. For the past 10 years, Steve has been on the leading edge of the SoC revolution. Today, he serves as a senior architect for Sonix, addressing the unique challenges of SoC integration through on-chip network IP, specializing in handheld systems. Previously, Steve was the chief IP architect for a small company offering video and serial interface IP cores. The floor is all yours, Steve.
Well, thanks, John, and hello to everyone. I hope you find today's information useful. Now, before I dive into the technical content of today's discussions, I wanted to take just a moment to cover the unlikely case that there's still somebody out there who hasn't heard of SONICS. It's fairly well accepted now to anyone developing SoCs that the interconnect in a design is a separate block in the design, and it requires its own development as part of the project. Now, some companies still do that development in-house, but a growing number are recognizing it's more cost-effective to outsource this IP. Well, SONICS pretty much single-handedly has defined this market. There are now multiple companies providing such IP, but SONICS is by far the market leader in this segment. There are over a half a billion pieces of production silicon with our interconnect inside, and this covers a wide range of applications from consumer electronics like flat panel TVs to application processors for cell phones to collision avoidance systems for cars to wireless modems for various prototypes to strange specialty devices like fish finders. Now, most other blocks of IP on a chip can be developed to a much greater extent in isolation. But because the interconnect plays such a central role, it's almost always impacted by system-level design considerations and decisions. Now, power management is one of the most important such considerations for today's SoCs, and it's that topic that we cover today. So I apologize for starting you off with an eye chart, but I think you can understand my essential claim without needing to see every number in the chart. Now, in the past, power management has been unnecessary in many cases. I think a simple design example can demonstrate how that is now pretty much a thing of the past. So let's consider a fairly typical consumer-type device using 65-nanometer technology with an ASIC core area of on the order of 6 millimeters on a side. With standard cell densities that's available today and the automatic place and route density we will get, we're talking about a design of about 17.5 million gates and about a million flip-flops. So let's assume the product is designed to run about 200 megahertz, which is pretty common today. In the first column in this chart, it shows the power dissipation of the device if we use the TSMC's 65-nanometer logic process, coming in at just over 8,000 milliwatts. Now, there are two probable limitations to consider: battery life if the device is mobile, and thermal limitations in all cases. And if we want to use a cheap plastic package and limit how hot the device gets to maybe about 115 degrees or so, then we can dissipate about 1.2 watts. So our 8 watts simply won't cut it, even if we're willing to live with the 7 minutes of battery life. So what would happen if we simply move this design to the equivalent low-power process? Well, the yellow column tries to show this. It gets down to about 2 watts. That's still too hot, and it only raises the battery life to maybe 30 minutes. So the simplest extra thing we could do is to use the clock gating capability in the synthesis tool we have and insert clock gating everywhere. Now, this will be about 95% effective if your RTL is well written. And the last column shows that this, in fact, lets us satisfy our thermal limit and get the battery life up to maybe 5 hours. But remember, this is 5 hours doing nothing. These are just idle power numbers, and I've completely excluded the I.O. Ring. So it's entirely likely that when doing any activity at all, I'm going to have more than 5 times as many flops moving than when I'm idle. So we're still going to exceed our power limits. So my claim is that with very, very few exceptions these days, every SoC needs some form of power management. But of course, you already knew that, which is why you decided to attend today's webinar. So what kinds of things are people doing for power management? Now, this slide tries to show the basic techniques that are used with some attempt to organize them in a useful manner. Now, all of these techniques involve breaking up your SoC into separate pieces with the idea that each piece can operate in a different power state. Now, the techniques differ on how complex and how varied are the set of power states available at each piece. Really, the question for each SoC architect to answer is how far up the power management pyramid must he go. Now, by far the most common technique is power switching. This is the simplest technique, and it delivers the most power benefit for the least amount of complexity. With power switching, there's still a single regulated supply for all the pieces, which are typically called power domains. We add additional low resistance transistors to in the supply paths, and what these transistors allow us to do is to switch the supply on and off for the domain. So in this case, power management boils down to deciding which set of domains are needed to perform the current activities and switching off all the other domains. Now, retention is the next technique. Domains may vary, and they actually, in fact, may contain some state that controls their behavior. So if I want to power that domain off, I first have to take that state out of it and put it someplace persistent. And then, of course, I have to reverse the process when I want to power it back up. Now, the state save and restore process costs some power, and it takes some time. And this becomes a problem that ultimately limits the power savings that I can get when the domains are powered off, especially if they're powered on and off very frequently. Now, in these cases, retention capability can be added to these power domains. This usually involves using special cells that receive two power supplies, one that is switched on and off, and a second one that is much weaker but is always on. It's this weaker voltage that allows these special cells to retain their state when the main supply is switched off. Now, because these retention cells typically have greater area and allow worse speed performance, they are used sparingly. So the next technique is voltage and frequency scaling. So when just switching domains on and off isn't enough, then you have to start to control the degree to which they're on. And this is done by using different regulated supplies for different regions and varying the supply voltages as needed to accomplish your low power consumption. Now, this is a very powerful effect since power consumption scales with the cube of VDD. It is common that these voltage islands call voltage domains. And since the circuit will also perform more slowly when operating at a lower voltage, you have to slow down the frequency as well. Now, what they'll do is characterize the actual voltage frequency pairs as part of design during design time, and then program them into the on-chip power manager. Now, this characterization is actually quite complex because it introduces a much greater number of corners that you have to worry about in your simulations. And you also have to take into account your manufacturing margins that will come into play in any such device. Now, because of these exorbitant design costs and the loss of some benefit due to margining, that's why I think this technique is less frequently used. I'm only aware of one SoC supplier that currently uses open-loop voltage control. Now, I need to apologize for an error I let creep into the slide with respect to the speed step technology. It actually uses a closed-loop system, but not as shown here. The closed loop is around temperature, and it actually should be on the voltage and frequency scaling box. It's a technique applied that really relies on this pre-characterization and open loop control. Now, in the embedded space, it's far more common to use closed loop control of the variable voltage and frequency. National Semiconductor has branded this as adaptive voltage scaling. In this case, the power manager selects from a predefined set of frequencies, and then we have circuit speed monitors that are used to close the control loop, which will find the lowest possible voltage that can satisfy that frequency. Now, it's these circuit speed monitors that are the complicated things here. ARM has provided some for its processors as part of its IEM package. And I don't mean here to slight other processor IP providers. I'm just not as familiar with their offerings. but there is not yet a general purpose solution for general IP blocks that I'm aware of. And so for this reason, when AVS is applied, it tends to be used selectively on an SoC. So let's look at the most common solution, power switching, and let's take a look in detail at what's needed to actually implement it. Now you see my little blue SoC on the left there, which we've chopped up into individual switchable domains. And on the right are the elements of our solution, pretty much in a bottoms-up fashion. So we clearly need these special power switching transistors and isolation cells. And we can get these from the standard cell library provider. Now next, we need these switching transistors and isolation cells to be automatically inserted by the synthesis tool and recognized and handled properly by the place and route tool. And we can get CPF-capable tools that do this from our CAD tool provider. Now, of course, that means we need a CPF file in order to direct the tools. Well, we start to have a little bit of an issue here. We might need to make those ourselves, or we may be able to actually get them from the IP provider. Now, for this power management system to work, it needs a sensor network so that it can detect activity at various points around the system, and it needs a control network to be able to control all the power switches and isolation cells. And then, of course, it needs some sort of intelligent centralized control to manage all of it. Now, this task falls on the SoC design team. And once the power manager is designed, it needs to be validated. Now, this task also falls on the SoC design team, although there is much tool support available now for the process, as we just learned from the previous speaker. Now, before any of this can start, the architect needs to do his work. He needs to decide exactly where to break the SoC into domains and what subset of them need to be on for each activity mode of the device. Now, this involves estimating the power consumption for each domain and for each activity and checking that both performance and power consumption targets can be met on each activity simultaneously. Now, while there are a set of vendors offering RTL power estimation tools out there, it's entirely possible that RTL for the domains does not even exist at this point. So in my experience, each architecture team has their own ad hoc method for doing this work. Some use C or System C modeling, some use spreadsheets, some use MATLAB or other similar tools, and frankly, some just guess. Now, one thing is worthy of note from the previous slide, and that's that CPF is a bit different than most other languages you may be using. It's intended to support expression of all aspects of the power solution, and therefore has syntax for each of the various aspects. Specifically, you will find some constructs intended to capture the architectural intent, and other constructs intended to capture the implementation. Now, identification of power domains that exist, the operating modes intended on those domains, and how those modes are combined into coincident sets at the system level represent the architectural intent. Things like specification of libraries and cells to be used, rules to describe when they should be used and how they're hooked up, and definition of corner conditions that allow the results to be analyzed represent the implementation. So a simple example may help make this real. Now, this is a screenshot of the Sonics GUI for a simple design. And here I've color-coded the power domains, labeled them to show how we partitioned the design. In this case, they're just four simple domains, CPU, memory, peripheral, and an always-on domain, which is typically where your power manager is going to reside. So here's the information to be captured as part of the architectural intent. Note the four domains are identified, each having a power supply net, and we specify a set of operating modes for each domain, where each named mode is defined by a supply voltage and a clock period. So the intent, in this case, is obviously to use the DVFS. Now, not all combinations of states on the domains make sense to be combined at the system level. So here we define 7 system-level operating modes, where each is defined by a selected mode on each of the subdomains. Now, this is what CPF allows the architect to specify. Now, given a set of stimulus associated with each of these system operating modes, the architect's validation job starts to look a bit more manageable. He just needs a model that he can estimate performance and power consumption for each domain in its power mode and with its portion of the stimulus. Now, beautifully, the implementation team should later be able to use the real model to answer the same questions. Now, since I'm from an interconnect company, I obviously want to talk about interconnect. But as I said in the intro, there's no way that the interconnect is not significantly involved in all this power management stuff. Now, hopefully, the background provided so far can help frame some of the issues and provide some useful vocabulary with which to discuss them productively. Now, I'm betting that at the beginning of a project, when a list of requirements are being created for the SoC interconnect, a set of particulars around power management support are probably not on or not high on that list. Now, maybe they should be. I've listed here a set of interconnect properties that directly relate to power management implementation. Now, I'm not going to discuss all of them here today. Some are obvious. Does the interconnect come with a CPF description? Does it support sideband signaling to transport some of the activity indications and the domain controls? Does it support asynchronous bridging between different voltage domains? And is the RTL organized with the right hierarchy so that the tools can manage the domain partitioning? And does the retention state have separate resets for power on and for wake up? But the ones I've circled in red are not so obvious. And I want to speak about these in more detail. Now, the picture here shows several voltage domains, but it could be equally applicable to just power domains. And we said that there needed to be an application power manager, but we didn't talk about how the power manager knows when it's safe to change an operating mode of a managed domain. The mode transitions at the various domains need to be coordinated with one another. Now, the big question is, how does the APM know when it's safe to power down a node? That is, when the domain goes from some sort of activity to idle, how quickly can the APM act? And likewise, how does the APM know when it's time to power the domain back up? Now, the last thing we want to have happen is to lose a transaction that is in flight. If the interconnect is powered down at the wrong time, a response could be lost in the interconnect, and this would corrupt a transaction and create a problem for the initiating core. And in fact, the problem is bigger than just lost responses. Is it okay for the APM to shut down the interconnect or the slave in the middle of an initiator burst, even if it doesn't corrupt the individual transfers? Typically, the answer is no. So what we need, in fact, is atomic shutdown at burst boundaries. Now, one way to do this is with a proprietary handshake between the initiator and the application power manager. The core basically tells the ATM when it's at an atomic boundary. But then the APM has to wait for a bounded time to let the communications drain through the interconnect and to the slave. And that means then that there's a lot of time that you're waiting where statistically you didn't need to, and so you're just wasting power. Conservative answers tend to waste power. And there's also a very real problem with proprietary handshakes if not all the initiator cores are sourced in-house. So a better solution, which is found in the Sonics interconnects, has the handshake interface for the power manager directly on the interconnect. It also has intelligent fencing as part of the interconnect. Now, this significantly simplifies the APM design. The APM can become just a collection of small unit power managers. And each of those only need to establish the policy decision, that is, domain up or domain down. The interconnect can handle all the implementation of the policy. When the power manager requests a power down, the interconnect puts up a flow control fence. Now, this fence allows open bursts to continue, but stalls in order to avoid starting a new burst. And once then, of course, the burst boundary is reached, that core interface is fully blocked. Now, when it's fully blocked, and it's delivered all its requests to the slave, and they've all had their responses delivered back to the initiator, then the interconnect can return an acknowledge handshake. And this power down OK signal from the interconnect indicates that communications have achieved a clean atomic shutdown. The power manager then can isolate and power it down without any risk of corrupting communications. Now, the flip side of this coordination problem is illustrated at the slave core. The interconnect provides activity signals for each socket, and these permit the unit power manager associated with that slave core to wait until the last possible minute before powering up the target, and it informs the power manager immediately when accesses are completed so it can power it back down. And, of course, the result in product is interconnect handshakes that are simpler to design for the application power manager and maximum power savings for the SoC itself. Now, I know people don't commonly think of interconnect arbitration as a power consumption issue. So let me spend a minute to show you how it is. Here we have a multi-domain system, and note that both the CPU and the programmed I.O. or peripheral subsystem are in separate domains, so they can be independently managed. And we want the DMA to construct work queues for the CPU while the CPU sleeps. Then we want the CPU to wake up and perform the processing task and go back to sleep. And when the CPU wakes up, it operates mainly out of DRAM. So the CPU and DMA accesses are shown here in green. Now, the CPU adds a significant power drain to the system, but we can know what that is. If we know the software path length of the task the CPU is going to perform, then we can compute the power impact it has by multiplying that software path length times the average number of cycles per instruction to get how long it stays awake. Now, of course, hidden and unstated is the assumption that there's independence between the DMA and CPU tasks. If the power manager makes an independent power decision, such as to lower the voltage or the clock rate for the PIO device in order to further reduce power, a surprising result can occur. The DMA block continues to launch requests at the PIO, but the PIO has slowed down. Now, this can cause the request stream to clog up with DMA requests. Now, the top interconnect and the boundary socket between the two interconnects becomes a shared resource, even though the connection pairs are completely independent paths. And this is where arbitration becomes an issue. Arbitrating only at burst boundaries allows the DMA burst to temporarily block the CPU from using that socket until the next burst boundary. Now, this tends to slow the CPU accesses and effectively increases the processor's CPI. Now, I created a real model for this effect using the Sonics tools. Now, the top curve here shows how the CPU latency degrades as the PIO clock rate is slowed, and the same effect would happen if the PIO data rate were increased. The bottom curve shows how the CPI for the processor then degrades as well for the given software instruction mix and the cache performance that I modeled. Note that the effective CPI almost doubles over this range. This means that the awake time for the CPU doubles, so we can expect the CPU power consumption to increase significantly. In fact, in all likelihood, that unexpected increase will likely wipe out any savings we had from slowing down the PIO core. So what is a power manager to do when slowing down a device actually increases system power? How is the architect's upfront modeling supposed to cope with this kind of coupling? Now, I used the same tools to show the same scenario if I just changed the arbitration for that socket between the two interconnects and made it use multi-threaded non-blocking protocols. The pink line shows the CPU progress is now independent of the rate of DMA progress at the PIO system, and the CPI line is beautifully flat. Now, what this means is the CPU awake time does not change, and as a result, the power saved by reducing the voltage at the PIO is actually saved, and we get the result we wanted. So hopefully this example also serves to illustrate how difficult it could be to design the system's power management function without such independence. It is important to include such subtle requirements when speccing your interconnect for power-managed systems. Okay, so in summary, let me run back through what I think I've told you. Power management has become critical and it's now needed on all SoCs. The most common power management technique is just power switching. Architecture support for power management design is still pretty ad hoc. CPF is really helpful and it supports the capture of both intent and implementation. And there's good tool support for implementation and validation with CPF. The features of the interconnect can be critical in achieving your power management intent. And the specification of these features is often missed in the IP selection criteria, and that is especially true for the interconnect. Okay, I'm going to turn it back over to John now, and we'll get into the Q&A session.
Okay, thanks a lot, Steve, for a great presentation. And we've got a couple of interesting questions that we have here. The first one I'd like to address to Sonix and Steve Hamilton. The question, it says, we're using power switching for the first time on our next design, but we only have a few switching domains. What kinds of things do you think we have to evaluate or validate?
Well, even with the simple technique, power switching domains, you've got a certain number of control signals that go to those domains. One to control the isolation transceivers for any paths that cross the boundary, the hardware reset for the domain, obviously the signals that control the voltage switches, maybe clocks are turned off or on during the domain downtime. So there is, for any such situation, there is a specification that's been written up which says how you're supposed to sequence those transitions. First you apply the voltage, then you remove reset, then you restore clocks, then you unisolate. So whatever that sequence is, you need to be sure that your operating circuit actually performs those functions. And so this is where some of the formal validation tools and the simulation-based tools really come in handy.
Could I add a couple observations?
Sure, go ahead.
I think I completely agree with what Steve just said. I'd like to add a couple other gotchas. One is in when you're power switching, looking at how the switches are physically implemented and the rush currents associated with them is something that you need to take into careful consideration, how you might want to sequence those over time. And that's going to, of course, change the power uptime that takes the number of clock cycles, from tens to hundreds of clock cycles. Associated with that is really understanding what the cost of the overhead of power shutoff is versus the actual amount of time that the device is going to spend in the standby operation for that part of the system. And it may, if the ramp time to get back into this normal system operating mode is very high, there's an intermediate strategy of using state retention cells within the block so that you can keep the key state and reduce the ramp-up time when you're powering back up. And so this is a kind of analysis that you may use in conjunction with an emulation technology that's capable of dynamic power analysis.
Okay, the next question we have, I think either Steve can address this one. And basically the designer says frequency scaling is one of the most used techniques even before power switching. For example, running the SoC at 32 kilohertz and then upshifting to 200 megahertz or more when it requires to do the work. Can either of you or both of you comment on that?
I'll take it first, Steve, if that's okay.
Go right ahead.
Okay, I would say no. In my experience, it's actually one of the least used and kind of the hierarchy that you see today for people that care about power. We didn't talk much about it today, but having multi-threshold libraries is probably the most common way to control power consumption today. There's a lot of designs that still don't take advantage of clock gating kinds of techniques in order to dampen the dynamic power analysis. Certainly, there are some more sign-off requirements if you're going to be providing a wide range of functional operation of frequencies, because you don't always get the same kind of linear scaling across the chip. And so the sign-off, you can go from a few modes of operations to, you know, over 100 different modes that you and corners that you have to sign off. And so it can be quite complicated if you haven't planned for it in advance. So I would say, you know, in my experience, it's probably actually near the bottom in terms of low power design techniques and its actual deployment today.
Yeah, I think my experience agrees with yours, Steve. And the reason is obviously leakage, right? So, I mean, you could simply stop the clock and eliminate any clock-related power, but you still would have the leakage. And so it's saving the leakage power is what the benefit you get by switching the domain. And as the processes get finer and finer geometries, they are leakier and leakier, then I think that we've seen a discontinuation, really, of the clock gating or the clock switching as a primary mode, and the replacement of it by power switching as a primary mode.
The next question that we've got is addressed primarily to Steve Hamilton from Sonics, but both of you might want to comment on it. Earlier you mentioned a 65 nanometer design example. The next design is the user's next design is using 45 nanometers, and he'd like to hear from both speakers how they think that will impact their power consumption.
Yeah, well, it's going to go up.
Correct.
The transistors are getting smaller, and the current capacity is getting higher. But again, that really only shows up in terms of the speed that you have when you're operating. The dominant thing here is the leakage continues to increase. And so it will tend to make the requirements that you have today will persist in the next generation, but they will hit you more quickly and on smaller granules. And so the amount of domains you need to have, the rapidity with which you need to switch them, you know, all of the same levers you're pulling, you're going to be pulling more frequently.
All right. The next question is, I guess Steve Carlson can tackle this one, and it is, how much power can be saved by using a power-aware RTL with the Cadence Flow versus a non-power-aware RTL?
So when once you've walked yourself into a particular micro architecture, you've determined an awful lot about the power consumption already. And so what we're seeing is you know, the strategy that our customers really pushed us towards and the industry at large was to have a power strategy description that's orthogonal to the RTL. And so we overlay a common power format description of what we want the power strategy to be, and then we can analyze the functional behavior of the RTL under that strategy, make changes in the CPF file without having to change the RTL. And so you can do a lot more exploration without having to rewrite and revalidate the RTL at each step of the way. The amount of power that can be saved RTL kind of hand optimization, you can probably do as well as 20%, but a lot of that 20% can be done through automation techniques that are built into the synthesis and implementation tools today as well. So, you know, my recommendation would really be, you know, in the RTL, you know, make sure that you have embedded a power efficient microarchitecture, and you can use tools like our C-to-silicon technology that let you move up to that next level of abstraction and look at different microarchitecture organizations of the design and see how that might impact the power dissipation, and then generate the RTL, overlay the different power strategies on top of that, and go through that process of continuous refinement, choosing where the state retention cells might need to be in order to optimize the transitions between power down and up, et cetera.
One of the attendees basically, I'm not sure whether he was misheard or not, pointed out that someone said that the power goes up as the cube of the voltage, and that he believed that the formula was really P equals 0.5 CV squared. Could someone elaborate on that?
Good news, Steve.
Yes, the current goes up also as a strong function of voltage, and so that's where the cube comes from. If you look at the current equations for a transistor in saturation mode.
Right. Let's see. One more question, I think, if we have enough time for it. Where are we? Now, that was the one. Let me see if we have one more. In general, what trends do you see in terms of what people will be doing on power wave design coming down the road?
There's a couple of key areas that we look at. We're talking primarily about SoC design today, and so if you look at the composition of an SoC, there's a lot more analog content on the chips, and so this is an obvious area of expansion. And then as we both have been talking about today, architecture has an awful lot to do with the power profile for a particular device. And so a lot of the stuff that Steve talked to you through today has to do with architecture and system level design. And I think that's going to be an area where you see a lot of innovation going forward.
All right,
It's the area that's still the least covered. Right? I mean, a year or so ago, the techniques and the tools that we have available now to support the power intent capture and simulation of it and synthesis of it and automatic insertion of the power aware cells and the validation of the protocols, that didn't exist a year or so back. It does now. And the piece that is still remaining to really be closed effectively, I think, is the architectural modeling effort and the closed-loop experimentation side of it.
Very good. There's a lot of attention being, again, this is a question that the moderator is asking. There's been a lot of attention and a lot of discussion lately of 3D ICs. How do you see that trend impacting what you will do in your tools and design technology and design in general?
This has been something that we've seen a trend for some time. A lot of design starts over the past few years have come out of the consumer marketplace, and form factor and energy efficiency are paramount to value propositions in those spaces. And so the experience that we have in both the PCB and packaging realm are really kind of merging along with this overlay as power is a key consideration. You look at as you shrink the size of a device, if you keep everything else constant, you can start to reduce the power footprint from a dynamic standpoint. You can also have a direct impact on the power if you look at the larger system-level packaging kinds of techniques. And so I talked about before, just stacking die, you can start to reduce the size of the I.O. drivers. They don't have to drive out onto a PCB system, and when there's a lot of I.O. activity, such as between processor and memory, for instance, that can have a significant impact on the overall power dissipation, and that's why you see the through-silicon via technology becoming very popular, but also for form factor reasons, going to system and package and being able to access the power of heterogeneous process technologies to get the best RF kinds of response, for instance, versus the latest and greatest digital process, and being able to put them into a single package in a way that better optimizes the energy.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, I think, unfortunately. Especially the I.O. capacitive load will be reduced by 3D packaging, and that's a big source of power consumption in many devices. Unfortunately, it continues the trend of increasing the density of silicon, and that means increasing the power density of silicon. And so, I think the thermal limits are going to get stressed far worse by 3D packaging than they do by 2D. And you can see that pretty quickly, that the amount of distance, a little bit of watt of energy has to travel to get out the surface of a die is far less than having to travel through a cube to get to a surface. So we'll probably see a greater influence of thermal limits on our design windows.
Right. Let's see. One other question. Where are we? Can either of you comment on the common power format versus the unified power format and the advantages or disadvantages of either one? I know that's a bit of a competitive question, but you might like to comment in any case.
Sure. It's not at all. By necessity, we need a common specification for what the power strategy is for a chip. You know, simply impractical to have the power strategy embedded into a netlist as it goes through the implementation flow. It's too hard to discern exactly what's going on and whether or not it has been implemented correctly. So the idea of establishing a golden specification for the power intent of the chip is something that's really key to successful low-power design. CPF came for UPF and has hundreds of design teams using it for, in some cases, 3 or 4 years at this point. The UPF came later and has gone through the IEEE process earlier this year, and so they're ramping that up right now. And so that's, as a company interested in interoperability, that's something that we embrace standards as well.
This is a kind of classic question, I think, that every editor ever born on the face of the earth in the technology field would ask, but what kinds of innovations or opportunities for further innovation do either one of you see without disclosing what you may be doing product-wise in the next year or so?
Well, I mentioned moving out across the SoC. So we talked about analog and mixed signal and things that might be done in memory and in embedded flash, et cetera, and up into system level design. In addition, there's also a number of other design techniques that can be applied to further reduce power. So for instance, just re-looking at how clocking is done on chip, there are different techniques like using pulse latches that are smaller, more power efficient memory devices, using ganged flops, we call dual flops, or it can be multi-bit flops where some of the clock circuitry is shared and it reduces the capacitive loading on the clock tree. There's about a dozen or so new design techniques that we're actively pursuing at this point in time with partners and have test chips and things underway. So there's a lot of innovation at the process level that we'll be leveraging, as well as design techniques, and then across the SoC and into analog mixed signal, and mentioned up into package design, as well as the system kinds of abstractions.
All right. Thanks a lot for answering that question. I think we've run a little bit over an hour, and I think there's been a tremendous amount of information. So I'd just like to thank both the speakers and all of the attendees who logged on and attended this session today. A couple of reminders. First of all, is that you'll see on your view you'll see the URL for this webcast, and it'll be posted within the next 24 hours. So there's been a lot of information and sometimes a lot to follow. If you want to get on and view this presentation offline or not in real time, download the overheads. You can do that at any time. If we haven't answered your questions, you can get back to either Cadence or Sonix directly, and they'll do their best to tackle your questions. Also, we'll also be taking a quick poll, I believe, at a closing survey will pop up on your screen after this Q&A. Please take a few minutes to fill it out. In any case, it's been great having you all on, and we hope to see you again sometime in the future. Take care.